You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community. And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon. From the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wagermiller. This is the Daily News for Tuesday, June 12th, 2018.
Is that basically you're going to remove someone erroneously. And there's all kinds of studies that have been done that show that even matching the first, last name, and date of birth can often lead to thousands, if not tens of thousands, of falsehoods.
A federal judge on Friday blocked a new voter registration law from going to effect. In today's feature report, WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester speaks with the Indiana ACLU, who are plaintiffs in an ongoing suit against the controversial changes to proposed voter registration purges.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Kathy Meyer continues the dark history of Karst Farm Park in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill is praising the Department of Justice for not defending Obamacare. Hill's support for the decision comes after U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions stated the DOJ will not defend the Affordable Care Act in a letter to Congress last week. Hill expressed his support for the decision in a press release issued yesterday. Hill cited a lawsuit from Indiana and 19 other states, which alleged the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. The Indiana Attorney General has stated that Obamacare represents federal overreach. In yesterday's press release, Hill says, quote, "Rather than legislating a one-size-fits-all mandate imposed nationwide, Congress should allow Indiana and all other states to exercise freedom in the ways that deal with the issue of health care for their own citizens," unquote. Indiana joined Texas, Wisconsin, and 16 other Republican-controlled states in a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of Obamacare in February.
Attorney General Hill's office is joining a campaign launched by Indianapolis Fraternal Order of Police in May to better comply with law enforcement. The new campaign, which is being led by the Indianapolis Fraternal Order of Police, is called, quote, hashtag think bigger, unquote. It purportedly aims to educate the public on best practices for interacting with law enforcement. Both the Indianapolis and Indiana State Fraternal Orders of Police have pledged $25,000 for public awareness education on the do's and don'ts during encounters with law enforcement, specifically at traffic stops. In a written statement issued yesterday, Hill says, quote, "Both police and civilians are accountable for their behavior at these times when tensions are high," unquote. The Indianapolis Fraternal Order of Police says the campaign will potentially save lives by teaching motorists how to conduct themselves during possible police interactions in light of, quote, recent tragic events involving police action shootings, unquote. Attorney General Hill's office says it anticipates further discussions with both Indianapolis and Indiana State Fraternal Orders of Police about helping to facilitate other programs with similar goals throughout the state.
Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton says the city opposes the repeal of net neutrality. The Federal Communication Commission's decision, made at the end of last year, eliminates equal access requirements, which prevent internet service providers like Comcast and AT&T from restricting the content internet users can view. With net neutrality repealed, providers are now allowed to prioritize certain websites, block content, or slow the speed at which sites load. In a statement yesterday, Mayor Hamilton wrote, quote, "Net neutrality is an essential element of 21st century democracy. Bloomington is standing with cities across the country to preserve this bastion of free speech and portal to economic and educational opportunities for all, unquote. Hamilton has joined over 110 other mayors in signing the city's Open Internet Pledge. Signatories of the pledge commit to safeguarding government internet to the extent permitted by law. The city's Open Internet Pledge states that its signatories will provide their residents with an open internet on municipal broadband and public Wi-Fi. It also states that mayors will prevent paid prioritization of government contact by service providers. The FCC's repeal is currently awaiting a vote in the House of Representatives, with the Senate already having voted to overturn the repeal. Legislators will be meeting with their constituents on the subject on June 26th.
The Sycamore Land Trust added over 80 acres to its Bean Blossom Bottoms Natural Preserve last week. The new land contains wetlands, forest, and existing farmland. Abby Henkel, communication director for the Land Trust, says building Bean Blossom Bottoms has been a continual process since the first acquisition 20 years ago.
It started with just one parcel and we've added on over the years. So this is just another addition to it. It's 84 acres. It has been farmed, but a lot of the land in that area is not ideal for farming just because it's wetland, it's swampy, and it floods a lot of the year. So what we've done there over the years is restored the habitat there, let the trees grow, let it flood when it needs to flood, and, you know, let the wildlife and the native plants come back. So that's eventually what will happen with this land. We'll probably farm it for a few years while we figure out what to do with it and how to take care of it. And that's farming it for a few years is actually maybe better than just letting it get overgrown with invasive species. So that's kind of our management plan at this point.
Bean Blossom Bottoms and its new land hosts a number of protected and endangered animal species. The Indiana bat, Kirtland snake, and the crawfish frog all call the area home. In the total, the preserve helps preserve the habitats of over 12 endangered species. Henkel says that balancing public accessibility with protecting these endangered species can be difficult. For the new acquisition to the Bean Blossom Preserve, there will be minimum human presence allowed.
There's no plans to add a trail to it anytime soon. It's hard to access. It's not near the current trail. So public access is really important to us, as is, you know, letting nature take its course. So that's why we put trails parts of the preserve that we think are best suited for it, and then there's a lot of the preserve. I mean, this is now over 600 acres that will just kind of be on its own.
Bean Blossom Bottoms Nature Preserve has been named a state important bird area by the National Audubon Society, as well as being dubbed a wetland of distinction by the Society of Wetland Scientists.
Two City of Bloomington water and sewer system improvement projects are moving forward. First, the Utilities Department is moving ahead on the reconstruction of the Jordan River culvert from 2nd Street to 4th Street. Utility engineer Jane Fleeg told the Utilities Service Board yesterday that design work was put on hold back in 2014 due to the city's streetscaping plans for the area. Fleeg presented the board with an agreement that now allows design of the project to move forward.
We have come to an understanding with the Planning and Transportation Department for the portion of the design amendment that will be theirs, which would be the traffic signal at 3rd and Lincoln and the streetscaping issues. The rest of this memorandum of understanding lays out the portion that is CBU's responsibility, which is basically increases due to inflation. We've gone from 2014 up to 2018, and they need to be able to charge their current billing rates.
CBU originally contracted with Donahue and Associates for the culvert design for $399,000. Fleeg says the contract cost will go up by more than $70,000 due to inflation. The culvert is part of a larger storm water system that reroutes the Jordan River underground. The deteriorating culvert prompted the closure of the intersection at 3rd and Lincoln Streets in April last year. City of Bloomington Utilities made temporary repairs to the culvert at that time. The board approved amending the Donahue design contract, as well as an agreement for laboratory improvements at the Dillman Road Wastewater Treatment Plant. Capital Projects Manager Mike Hicks says architects from Indianapolis-based Synthesis Incorporated will start by doing a space study of the lab.
They'll look at our existing space and interview our employees, lab staff, and develop some conceptual designs and present them to us in a final report with probable costs associated with them. We've asked them to look at three things. One was utilizing the existing space of the laboratory. Another would be to look at adjacent spaces that could be incorporated if we needed to expand the space. And a third would be to knock out the exterior wall and do an addition.
Hicks says improving the lab has long been on City of Bloomington Utilities' capital improvements list. Consultants Greeley and Hansen flagged the lab as needing improvements in a 1999 plant evaluation.
The owners of Arlington Heights Veterinary Hospital are working to get their practice up to speed after a fire partially destroyed their facility in northern Monroe County. Last week, the Monroe County Board of Zoning Appeals heard two variance requests from the veterinary hospital owners. A use variance, which will allow the owners to expand the facility at 4515 West Arlington Road as they rebuild. The area is largely residential, but senior planner Carly Peterson says planning staff support the variance request.
The area is considered a gateway. We're moving towards a new county development ordinance, which would likely change the allowable uses in this area. Presently, the code doesn't allow for business service uses, but there's a great likelihood within our updated ordinance that this area may provide for those types of uses to occur.
Arlington Heights is also requesting a variance to allow for a temporary trailer on the property so they can continue to provide veterinary services while rebuilding.
So the required side yard setback in RE1 is 20 feet, and they would like to be closer to that. We would limit them to being 5 feet from that property line. This would be a temporary encroachment.
The Animal Hospital has a second location on Bloomington's south side on Old State Road 37. Zoning Board Chairman Peter Kazmarchik asked the hospital's manager, Michael Livingston, about services available at the Arlington Road location during its rebuild.
What business will you be able to do when the construction is going on? And will it be administrative? Are you going to be able to see animals, or how's that going to work out?
So what the plan right now is some people, depending on what the animal has going on, if it's an emergency, they still will have to travel to our other location if they're willing to. But the plan right now is to have a few exam rooms. We'll be able to run blood work is the plan. So we'll be able to get things started on blood work. Any wellness exam, which would include vaccines, any types of medications, we should be able to take care of most if there's allergies involved. There's a few things, you know, ear problems, we'll be able to get those clean and taken care of. We're going to have techs and doctors that will be able to do those full exams and get things going and possibly even take care of the animal in full. If they have to have anything, a surgery, if they have anything too comprehensive, then they will have to go to our other location. We won't have a surgery table or anything like that. We'll have some treatment tables to, you know, do nail trims and stuff like that, but it will mostly be wellness type of visits.
The Board of Zoning Appeals unanimously approved both variances during their meetings last week.
The Bloomington Plan Commission struggled to give a proposed affordable housing complex its final plan approval in its meeting last night. A majority of commission members voted to support the plan despite environmental and traffic concerns. Commission member Jillian Kinsey says it was not an easy decision.
We are charged with assuring that what's been presented today fits the code and it meets the intent of the code and the requirements, that it meets the pre-plan. I don't know how we can deny this, actually, given those conditions. So I think we're in a really tough spot here in terms of what we're able to do.
The Annex Group, part of Mecca Companies Incorporated, is proposing a 146-unit affordable housing complex for 1100 North Crescent Drive. Zoning Planning Eric Grulich told the commission the 8-acre parcel was rezoned last year to a planned unit development, or PUD, to accommodate plans for the affordable housing complex. Previously zoned single-family residential, Grulich says the property has sat empty for 70 years due to two sinkholes and some steep slopes.
So when you look at this map of the environmental constraints, you can see a very narrow portion of developable area. This land, if it were to be zoned for or developed for single-family residences, I think we figured out you might be able to get 10, maybe 15 single-family lots on there at best, and you'd have to build a public street and a lot of other improvements, and so the cost-benefit didn't really ever pan out for that. So in situations where you have a lot that is heavily environmentally constrained, clustering all of your development in one central location and avoiding all of those environmental features is the best management practice for that.
In the rezoning and PUD approval process, developers were given height and buffer zone exemptions. Grulich says exemptions aside, the rest of the site plan meets all the requirements of the Unified Development Ordinance. Area residents voiced concern not only about the environmental conditions, but about the increased traffic development would bring. Several commission members felt they couldn't say no to the project after it had already come so far. Commission member Susan Sandberg had no trouble supporting the project. She puts social equity concerns over environmental concerns. She says managing the city's growth could be painful, but called the city's need for affordable housing extreme.
We are going to have to look at how do we build more houses for individuals in all income ranges, because that lack of housing in our community is what drives the costs up. We are some of the highest housing costs in the state of Indiana, and we're not the only college town.
Commission member Nicholas Kappas says he could not support the plan, in part because it didn't fit with the city's newly adopted comprehensive master plan.
And this exact petition is what has driven me to make sure that this never happens again, that we are weighing environmentalism versus affordable housing in our community that values these things extremely high. And I don't think one is greater than the other. They're equal.
Kappas and Commission Member Beth Kate abstained from the vote. Before the vote, Commission Member Les Coyne says he was astonished the project got as far as it did.
It just appears to me we're bending over backwards to make this thing fit. I'm going to vote for this because it's a matter of fair play at this point. It's gone too far down the road, but I'm just dumbfounded here. I understand the desperation, but we're just at the start of this, folks. How much are we going to bend it later?
Commission members Coyne, Andrew Seabor, Carol Stewart-Gulias, Jillian Kinsey, Heather Maritano, Susan Sandberg, and Brad Whistler voted in support of the project.
The section of Gatesville Road in Brown County that approaches State Road 135 is expected to close tomorrow between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. The closure will happen, weather permitting, so the Indiana Department of Transportation's Martinsville unit can replace a drainage pipe located under the section of Gatesville Road that approaches State Road 135. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wagermiller. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
A federal judge on Friday blocked a new Indiana voter registration law from going into effect. As WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester reports, the Indiana chapter of the ACLU and the Secretary of State's office are now heading into discovery over the proposed purges of voter rolls.
A federal judge is blocking a new program that would allow state officials to purge voter data from Indiana's election rolls. The ruling, issued Friday by U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Walton Pratt, temporarily bars the Interstate Voter Registration Cross-Check Program from going into effect. The Cross-Check Program is meant to prevent elections fraud and double voting. That's where voters are registered in two states and vote in both. The program originated in Kansas in 2005 and has since spread to 27 states. CrossCheck scans states' voter registration rolls and eliminates duplicate voters, people who show up on multiple state voter registrations. But the program has been criticized for knocking legitimate voters off of voter registrations. Sometimes that's because they share the name of someone in another state, or because they once lived in another state and haven't notified the Secretary of State's office of their change in address. A Harvard study published last fall found that for every one duplicate voter knocked off of voter registration programs, CrossCheck knocked 200 legitimate voters off of voter registration rolls. Three states have recently signaled they would drop implementation of CrossCheck due to voter registration concerns. The Indiana chapter of the NAACP also alleges that African Americans and Hispanics are more likely to have similar names, and that the CrossCheck program would unduly affect Black and Brown voters. Indiana joined the CrossCheck program in April of last year. Judge Pratt's decision to halt the implementation of the program cited in favor of the government watchdog group Common Cause. Common Cause has signaled it will continue pursuing its lawsuit against Secretary of State Connie Lawson's office over implementation of CrossCheck. The Secretary of State's office is the defendant in the case due to the fact that the secretary is the highest-ranking elections official in the state. Jan Mensch is an attorney with the Indiana branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, which is representing Common Cause in the suit. He says one of the primary arguments in the case was CrossCheck's alleged tendency to strike voters from rolls.
That's the primary concern, is that basically you're going to remove someone erroneously. And there's all kinds of studies that have been done that show that even matching the first, last name, and date of birth can often lead to thousands, if not tens of thousands, of false hits.
According to existing federal law, voters can be purged from voter rolls only if they formally confirm that they have moved. Voters can also be removed if they don't respond to a written notice and neglect to cast a ballot for two consecutive general election cycles, or about 4 years. Common Cause and the Indiana ACLU argue that the CrossCheck program is a violation of the National Voter Registration Act. The act was established in 1993 and governs current federal regulations on voter registration. In a written statement sent to WFHB, Secretary of State Connie Lawson's office says, quote, "We have never had a voter come forward who is incorrectly removed from the list. We are currently working with our attorneys to review our options moving forward. We respectfully disagree with the ruling," unquote. Judge Pratt's ruling puts implementation of the CrossCheck program on hold for Indiana. According to Mensch, both the Indiana ACLU and the Secretary of State's office will be conducting discovery for the upcoming trial. During discovery, parties in the case will collect testimony and evidence to support their arguments in the upcoming hearing. When that hearing will be held, however, is unknown.
In the meantime, the law won't go into effect. Basically, it maintains the status quo of how the state has dealt with voter rolls in prior elections. So that gives us and our clients, and should give voters in Indiana, some assurance that things won't change.
Friday's decision from Judge Pratt came shortly before the Supreme Court handed down a ruling on a similar case in Ohio. In a 5-4 decision this week, with the Supreme Court splitting down party lines, the court ruled that Ohio is allowed to purge its voter rolls. Plaintiffs in that case argued that, although Ohio followed the National Voter Registration Act, it did not have a right to purge voter rolls. Ohio wanted to remove voters who had not voted for 6 years and who had failed to confirm their Ohio addresses. Mensch says the Ohio case ruling may support Common Cause and the Indiana ACLU in their legal fight. He says that by reaffirming the importance of the National Voter Registration Act in its Ohio decision, the Supreme Court set precedent for the case against Indiana's CrossCheck program.
Well, they're brought under the same law, and they do involve voter list maintenance, but the issues are different. In that case, they were removing voters based on failure to vote for 2 years. That sort of triggered the process. But what the decision does affirm is the importance of this fail-safe notification process, which is exactly what Indiana removed. So the idea that you have to send out this notice, wait 2 election cycles, which is actually 4 years, before you can, and the voter can't vote during that time, before you can remove them from the voter rolls. And we believe the Supreme Court decision actually affirmed and reaffirmed the importance of that process and its mandatory nature.
Since its introduction, several states have dropped out of the CrossCheck program, citing fears over voter security and privacy. According to the Associated Press, Kentucky, Alaska, Florida, Washington, Massachusetts, New York, Oregon, and Pennsylvania have all resigned from the program. For WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm Kathy Meyer.
And the story continues.
And in 1893, the commissioners bought 160 acres of the Cole Farm, 4 miles west of town. And this property had once been home of racehorses, and there was a racetrack on the site. The commissioners believed that they could sell the old poorhouse to get enough money to pay for the new ones. The building was to be made out of brick, and the brick was made from clay that was dug at the site of the poorhouse itself. At one time, there was a round pond in front of the poorhouse, the brick house, that had been where the clay had been dug out. The house itself had 30 rooms. The kitchen and laundry facilities and some of the other working areas of the house were in the large basement, a deep stone basement. The upper two floors were used for housing the residents who stayed there. In 1913, that amounted to 36 people, evenly divided between men and women, most of them elderly. The farm itself had a lot of other facilities to provide food for the residents. There were vegetable gardens, crop fields, cows, chickens, hogs, and so on. In 1903, the superintendent reported that they had made $1,225 from sales of produce from the farm, and left over they had 40 tons of hay, 41 hogs, $100 worth of clover seed, 15 head of cattle, 150 bushels of wheat, 180 bushels of oats, 500 bushels of corn. In 1907, however, the inspection by a grand jury found that conditions were not good. There were improvements needed, and inspection of the residents at that time said that there were 27 inmates, many of them feeble-minded, epileptic, crippled, insane, and only 5 were able-bodied and able to work. A 1910 inspection showed that the committee who went was shocked beyond expression by conditions there. It was necessary for the county to provide additional help and to address the conditions under which the unfortunate there were living. Especially help was needed in the kitchen and in the annex, which is very appropriately called the pest house because there were barred windows and doors and padded cells where people who were mentally ill and couldn't be managed by the supervisors were locked up and treated in ways that no one would dream of keeping anyone now. But they say the annex was in an unsanitary condition, dangerous to the inmates and to the people who have to care for them. It is necessary that water closets be installed and connected with the cesspool, that ventilation be installed in the ceilings, and they needed fire pumps, which are not in repair in case there was any kind of fire. Later on, these improvements were made. As other social service agencies and programs came into effect, there was less need for the county poor farm to exist. In 1954, it was discontinued. The property sat abandoned and derelict for many years and was subject to a great deal of vandalism and destruction. A fire destroyed the barn in 1969. And despite many years of the county commissioners talking about establishing a museum or history farm or some sort of use of the property, all of these ideas came to naught. And after the fire destroyed the barn, Ralph Rogers offered to demolish all of the buildings for free. It was said that he did this to destroy the dreaded symbol of being a childhood orphan when he was moved from one relative to another, with the specter over his head all of the time that he could end up at the poor farm. In 1967, the County Park Board was established but not funded. It was disbanded, and in 1971, another park formed, and the property became the first county park. A contest was held to name it, and the commissioners leased the property to Monroe County Parks and Recreation and became the park that we know today, Karst Farm Park.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Andrew McKiernan, Jonah Chester, Francis Sheets, and Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Jonah Chester.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Jace Poling. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadeke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Aaron Wagermiller.
And I'm Don Guerra. Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that a Denver baker was not legally liable for his refusal, based, he claimed, on religious beliefs, to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. It wasn't that Jack Phillips' free speech would have been violated, the court's majority said in their